When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There's truth in what you say, and I love working with athletes but you can't ask them to act outside. You know, athletes playing athletes is one thing. Athletes doing Shakespeare is something else. So as long as you keep them in their world, they're great.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball Americas from Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today's episode is personally a dream come true for me and something I hope everyone enjoys. Today I'm talking to Ron Shelton, who was an Orioles minor league infielder in the late 60s, but is better known as the filmmaker responsible for films such as White Man Can't Jump, Tin Cup, Blue Chips, and of course, Bull Durham. First ballot sports movie Hall of Famer, and just incredible storyteller. Today's episode is kind of a bit of a hybrid. We spend the first half talking about his life in baseball, which is incredibly interesting in its own right. The Orioles were the premier organization during that era, and Shelton dives into the life in baseball that led him to create the ultimate minor league baseball movie. We then, in the second half, dive into movies. If you want a ton of Bull Durham talk, it's not as much here. Ron just released a book called The Church of Baseball, The Making of Bull Durham. Highly recommend any fans of the movie check it out. Really interesting deep dive on both his baseball career and the making of this movie. Everything you'd want on the creation of Bull Durham, from him writing the script to casting the movie, the story of making it, some battles with the studio. Just a really entertaining read. Highly recommend it. It was a real treat for me to chop it up with Ron in general. On the back half, you'll hear me reference another podcast or being a part of another podcast. That is my other show, Big Screen Sports, which is a sports movie podcast that comes out weekly if you're interested. But the back half of this interview will also be airing on that show. So you'll hear references to that. So if you get a little bit confused, that's why. Also of note, this episode is not quite as child-friendly as some others. The explicit tag should be on it. A little bit of language that is just reflective of the language that sometimes is in his films. So just a heads up there, if you listen with kids in the car. But really enjoyable episode with Ron. It was, again, a huge treat for me. I hope everyone enjoys it. Episodes are from Phenom the Farm, drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoyed this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Go check out past interviews, and if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. We have some great episodes coming up. We have one with a big league reliever turned artist and one of the greatest pitchers in college baseball history, or at least of the past 15 years. So a lot of good stuff to look forward to there. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. BA is covering the fall league. We got team top 30s coming soon. Always good things happening at BA. Always a good time to be a subscriber. With that, let's talk to the great Ron Shelton. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom of the Farm, he was signed as an undrafted free agent by the Orioles in 1967 out of Westmont College, former minor league infielder and writer, director of films such as Bull Durham and Tin Cup, and the author of a new book, The Church of Baseball, The Making of Bull Durham, Home Runs, Bad Calls, Crazy Fights, Big Swings, and a Hit, Ron Shelton. Ron, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Also, White Man Can't Jump, which I know they play basketball in Texas.
They do. Yeah. No, we'll get into that. Yeah. So, also including Blue Chips and The Best of Times. You've certainly made your way around the sports movie universe, which we're going to get into on the back half of this run. I want to start off with a question. What is more difficult, squaring up a baseball or dealing with a studio as a first time director?
Well, dealing with a studio, even as a 20th time director, is quite difficult. Baseball is more honest than the studio team. But I kind of agree with Ted Williams. Hitting a baseball is probably the hardest thing in all of sports.
Extremely challenging. Extremely challenging. And if folks, if you want more info on how challenging it is dealing with the studio, go get Ron's book. It is it was eye opening. It's not what I view Bull Durham as the sacred text in this wonderful movie, and the turmoil behind the scenes, that battle does not come through in the film. Let's go back to your baseball career. Let's go back pre-movies. When did you first realize you had a future in professional baseball?
Well, I wanted to play since I was a kid, like everybody, but I was little, I was small. And even in high school, I was like the short, scrappy shortstop who, you know, managed to fight his way onto the varsity early because I was the scrappy guy. And, you know, I choked up that much and you couldn't get the ball by me, but I, you know, I'd hit 100 singles, but I was a good fielder. And I was Santa Barbara High School, where my hero was Eddie Matthews, Santa Barbara High School alum. And even when I left high school, no D1 school was in, nobody was interested in me. And certainly no professional teams. In the college I went to, Westmont was a very small, it was like D3 actually, but it had NAIA D3, but it had really good sports programs and baseball programs. And I went there, and between my senior year in high school and my freshman year of college, I went from, you know, 5'8", 150 pounds to 6'1", 185 pounds. And all of a sudden scouts and other people were saying, who's that guy? And I played third base. And I, at that point I thought I want to give it a shot to play professionally because I have the size now.
So you get picked up by the Orioles after your senior year. It's kind of in the fresh stages of the draft. Draft's only 2 years old. You get picked up after the draft as an undrafted free agent. At that point, there's no Baseball America. There's no real prospect coverage is not a thing at that point. There's no consensus on how guys stack up and anything for like that. What did you think the Ron Shelton path to the big leagues was?
Oh, you're not even thinking about the big leagues. You're trying to think that day, that town, how to get your hits, make the plays, show that you can play the game at a high level, including baseball IQ, and that you're the toughest guy out there. That the guy behind you doesn't beat you out, and that you have a chance to beat the guy ahead of you out. It's all about who's ahead of me, how do I beat him out? Who's behind me, how do I make sure he doesn't get my job?
Typically now guys get signed, they get sent out to short season or the complex league or something like that. They're assigned a role. You're going to be on this team. You're going to be, you know, maybe you're a starter, maybe you're a bench guy, whatever it is. You go out to Bluefield and it is essentially an open tryout. They send out double the roster. How long were you playing minor league baseball, playing in Bluefield, maybe the next year in Stockton before it stopped feeling like a tryout, before you were sure you had a spot?
It was always a tryout. And everybody will tell you that. I mean, every day you're fighting for your life. And I mean, I got out of Bluefield in 2 weeks, but it was a tryout. And the book tells an amazing story about it. So I fought my way to Stockton. Then I got hurt in Stockton and I came back. And then I went to, I had a great year, went to winter ball, went to the Texas League, and then double A, which was double A, and then the National League. And I never got released. I just, a strike of 72 hit. And I couldn't sit it out.
With that, when you get into pro ball, or at least like now, the minor leagues are development over winning. It is you've got this team of 25 and 20 are playing, so the five prospects can play. It's that sort of thing, and it's focused on that. The team wins 80 games, great. They lose 80 games, how'd the prospects do? When you were playing, when you came up, what was the culture around winning? What was the main goal for you and your teammates? Was it still intrinsically, you know, single-minded, like my development, then the team? Or was there this focus of, hey, we want to win the Texas League or the Cal League Championship?
Oh, you want to win. I mean, you're there because you're used to winning and you want to win. And everybody's a fighter. And, you know, you realize the organization didn't really care, but you care. The guys cared a lot. And but yes, the amazing thing about the minors back then is there was no coaching. I mean, it was a free-for-all. It was just Darwinian. May the strongest man win. I mean, I never got coaching. The only guys that got coaching were the bonus babies. Bobby Grich and Don Baylor got coaching. I didn't get coaching. They were my buddies too, by the way. But Don Baylor from Texas and later MVP in the American League. So they never said, look, here was some adjustment. There was no analytics. There was no radar gun. There was no video. I never saw to this day, I've never seen myself swing a bat.
How'd you hone your craft? How do you get better when there's no observation in that regard? You can't even self-observe.
You talk to guys talk to each other all the time. I mean, we're sharing secrets. How did you know, you're on a roll. What are you seeing? What are you looking at? What are you guessing? It was really appalling when I look back about how, I mean, I went from third base to shortstop to second base where I played most of my career. And I'm like, studying how do you turn a double play? Nobody told me. And I'm looking at all the great made things on games. Oh, that's the best way. And so you are self-taught, but you also, the good part of that is you have to or you don't survive. The bad part is, boy, I wish I had the coaching. You know, we weren't allowed to lift weights. It was considered it would make your muscles too tight because nobody knew what the hell they were doing. And only when Nautilus came in the 70s, the guys start lifting weights because it wasn't dead weight. Nautilus had the water, whatever, resistance. And guys like Bobby Grich, who hit like, and he and I are close, he's still, I like, he hit like one home run, and all of a sudden he hit 30 because of Nautilus. And then all of a sudden everybody started lifting. I never lifted a weight in my life. I wish the hell I would have been 10 years later, but it was a free for all. And it was, you're on your own.
Interesting. So now in the off season, guys will, they go back to their hometowns. They're doing a strict workout program, strict nutrition and training in a lab. Essentially they have cameras on their swing or if they're a pitcher and their delivery, things like that. How were you spending your off season? What were the time before spring training? What were you doing as a baseball player? And then just outside interests?
Well, I stayed in shape, but I didn't play much baseball, but I'd stay in shape playing basketball just to keep my wind and all that. But I would work. I know you need a job. Sears and Roebuck. I substitute taught in high schools for 3 years.
You sold to Lady Kenmore's?
I made the decorations. I was in the decoration department for Lady Kenmore's, and it was nasty work too. You were just trying to get through before you went back to training. And then I played winter ball once, which, man, I finished 142 games, and that was in Stockton. We won the championship, and then it was a real honor to get invited to the Florida Instructional League. You were one of 25 prospects, and I went there, and I hit over 300 in Florida, and that got me a AAA. So, I was on a path there. The strike didn't help, 72. That, a lot of guys' careers kind of ended. Nobody ever talks about that.
You mentioned needing a job in the offseason, which is still – you know, 40, 50 years later, still pretty common. A lot of minor leaguers who don't make a lot of money still have to work in the offseason, something like that. You say in the book, you get your $500 a week standard minor league salary. How far did that stretch in 67? This past year is the first year that organizations have covered housing back then. And for, you know, 50 years after, you're in charge of that. How are you living off that 500? What was the lifestyle in 67?
Well, in 67, you got in A ball, you got $3 a day meal money. And even in 67, that didn't go very far. Well, guys are living, you know, sharing apartments, ball players, or if you didn't, you know, you get the cheapest apartment. The ball players would know because the general manager would say the cheapest apartment in towns are the ones over there on the other side of the railroad track. And that's where you'd stay. And, you know, if you were living with a woman or something and you went on a road trip, they were terrified because there was gunshots. I remember in Stockton, there was always gunshots outside the apartment and the doors were like paper thin. But by the time I got to AAA, well, AA and AAA, even though you weren't making a whole lot more, 700, 800, I think I made 900 a month in AAA. You could live on that. You couldn't get past the season, but you could. You rent a house. We would rent houses and somebody have the upper floor and another guy'd have the lower floor, that kind of thing.
blending a baseball question with a movie question, when you're building out a Crash Davis or any sort of sports movie character, how much is you inventing a person off the top of your head, and how much is you pulling traits of remembrance from people you experienced in your own career? Like, I saw, you know, you describe your first minor league manager, Joe Altobelli, as a career AAA player at a cup of coffee in the majors. That sounds very, very familiar. So how much is I've got to come up with these people, and how much, you know, were you able to pull little parts of Nuke and pull parts of, you know, Billy Hoyle?
Well, they all come from real people, but they're usually composite of various characters, and then the imagination adds to them. But I knew a lot of Nuke LaLouches. Everybody that played pro ball talked about the Nukes after the movie. Said, oh my God, it's this guy, it's that guy. And that, they are the guys that have a God-gifted arm. They really can throw a ball to a brick wall. And they have great stuff. They just can't throw strikes, and they don't know how to pitch. They don't know how to change speeds. They don't know how. Then somebody comes up, you know, along with half of their God-gifted talent and makes it to the majors and has a great career. So it's the classic million-dollar arm, five-cent head guy. There is a million of them out there.
The one you leaned on being Steve Dalkowski, who has now become even more of an urban legend, I think, since Bull Durham has kind of elevated that. Like, how often was he referenced, just being in the Oriole organization? I know, the first time you saw him, you mentioned in the book that, you know, he came to ask Altobelli for money. Like, how often was that arm just referenced offhand?
Not often. At the time, I kind of latched on to it because not knowing I was going to become a writer or a director. He just was a fascinating character, the way Max Patkin was a fascinating character. And he wasn't strictly in my head when I wrote Nuke, but there was another guy. We had a guy on our team named Greg Arnold who was pretty crazy. I've talked to him since. He's sure that he was the model for Nuke. He was a top pick, you know, looking guy. He thought he was Engelbert Humperdinck, and he would sing in the roadhouses, and, you know, a wild character, and had great arm, no control. Dalkowski, I mean, the people say to me, who's the toughest guy you ever faced? And I'll tell them some guy you never heard of on one given night where he could throw the ball where he wanted, but then he'd walk 14 the next game. So, you know, those guys you never heard of were scary on the mound. Also, because they were harder to hit because one pitch would be on the outside corner at the knees and the next one would be at your head. You know, I found it easier to hit the higher I went in the minors because it was more of a chess match. There was a lot of talent, obviously, but, you know, they're not going to throw the ball over the backstop.
Yeah, you can actually dig. I mean, it's the logic behind Crash telling him to hit the ball. Don't let guys dig in.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, in the low minors, a guy will I got hit in the head on an 0-2 pitch leading off a game right there, taken to the hospital in Bakersfield. Now, why are you hitting the guy in the head 0-2 to start to lead the game? Well, that's because they don't know where the ball's going.
It's a nightmare. So you're in that Orioles organization. At the time, the Orioles are the premier organization in baseball. Each spring training, when you get that glimpse at Jim Palmer, Brooks Robinson, and Boog Powell, just the big league Orioles. How big was that gap really? And how loaded was the organization, you know, AAA down?
Well, we won two or three championships in my 5 years at different levels. And it was loaded. Everybody who wasn't like a first round draft pick wanted to get traded to a expansion team. They were just like Montreal had just started and maybe Seattle.
The Pilots.
Yeah, because I overlapped Jim Boughton, who I later got to know very well. And we were seeing guys go to Montreal that couldn't have made our Double-A team, honestly. And the Orioles were stacked. As I said one time, not that Crash Davis is this guy, but one of the models for Crash is a guy like Mike Ferraro. And Mike Ferraro was a third baseman. 4 years in a row, internationally, AAA All-Star. He never got a shot in the big leagues till he was 32 because he was backup for Brooks Robinson. By the time he was 32, he had some injury problems. And so, you know, they'd rather have him playing every day in AAA in case Brooks got hurt, he'd be ready, than sitting on the bench in Baltimore, where he'd be making a lot of money and getting a pension and all that. So I saw guys like that, and yet they played the game with passion and with seriousness, and they were really quality players. And they had this sort of lid on their righteous anger. You know, they had a right to be pissed off, but it wouldn't, they didn't let it really show. They were pros. They were hired guns. They were professionals, and I always respected that.
Well, when you were in AAA, the O's had Davey Johnson, who was an all-star. I mean, you're as blocked as you can be, too, at second base. Is there any, at that point, that's, you know, is there any recourse? Can you say, hey, trade me?
Well, here's how stacked they were. The Rochester had three minor league players a year in the row, I believe. You can look it up. Roger Freed, who they traded to the Phillies because he couldn't hit a curveball, even though he could hit a fastball 800 feet. Then Don Baylor. Don Baylor couldn't break into the Oriole lineup after his minor league player of the year. He comes back to AAA, and the minor league player of the year is Bobby Gritch, who's a shortstop with 37 home runs. And they trade Davey Johnson to make Bobby Gritch their major league second baseman. And then the strike hit. That's what happened to me. But if I'd hit, you know, if my lifetime average was 285 instead of 265, maybe I'd have found a home. But I'm not complaining at all. I got, you know, baseball's as close as we have to a meritocracy in the country. So, most of the guys who got there deserved it. And a few guys got screwed like Mike Ferraro.
Well, something I was curious about with your game is, especially this was back, I mean, stolen bases were a bigger thing back then, a lot more fun. You ran about 30, 40 times a year. So there's the guys like your Rickies and your Vince Colemans who they get on first and it's like, hey, this is a pit stop. I'm going to be at second. Running 30 to 40 times a year, what factored into when you hit the bag and you decide I'm going, like how many, what was the checklist of, you know what, I'm going to make a run at it?
Well, usually the manager give you a sign. You weren't on your own. The rookie Henderson's on his own, you know. It was situational. There's a time to steal and there's time not to steal. I never could steal off a lefty. I never could read that weird balk rule. The lead foot is behind the knee. And all. I mean, it's a weird translatable rule. But I remember playing against a team in Albuquerque that was the Dodgers. And they're managed by Del Grandal, and he knew he pitched out every time I stole. He just knew when I was stealing. They must have known the signs. And Ferguson or Yeager, they'd throw me out, and I'd go back to dugout and say, "Man, I don't want to steal against these guys." They know every time. So, but when I got to AAA, we didn't run much. We had a lot of power, a lot of power. That was more the Earl Weaver. Earl Weaver didn't run either. So when you got to AAA, you were doing it the Baltimore way.
Station to station. We talked a little bit before we started recording. You played at the Texas League. The Texas League, there's a line in Bull Durham, Crash talks about having to go back to the bus leagues. The Texas League is the bus league. Those rides are the beast. What was the Ron Shelton guide to survival on the bus?
Well, we were in Dallas-Fort Worth 2 years before it became the Rangers. So we were lucky. We were in a big city. I mean, between Dallas and Fort Worth at that time, there was nothing but farms and Six Flags over Texas, and we were next to Six Flags. But now it's, of course, one metropolitan area. So we got to fly to places and then bus. So I know other teams didn't have it as lucky. I mean, we would drive to Little Rock and Memphis and Tennessee and all that's Memphis and that Shreveport, that's not far away. But we'd fly to El Paso, obviously. Midland, Odessa wasn't in the league, but I would wave going over because of my family from that area. Tommy Lee Jones is from that area, a guy I love and have worked with, San Saba, Texas. But I would read on the buses. I didn't get into the card games. I played a little bit cards, but some guys would play for 12 hours, and I would read, try to get some sleep. You have to get in a mindset because you finish a game late. You don't go to the hotel. You get on the friggin' bus. 7 in the morning or somewhere else. When I played in the California League, there were some brutal ones. We went from Santa Barbara. They were in the league a little bit to Reno, Nevada. And you get out and you play a double. You know? I mean, it's just why we all use bennies and greenies and uppers and all that stuff because you know, it was not thought of as drugs. They weren't even illegal until like 2006. Mm-hmm. It was just like, instead of five Red Bulls, because they didn't have Red Bull, you'd take one of those pills. They were served in the training room, by the way.
What was the first experience you had? Like when you get into the clubhouse at Bluefield or something like that, was there anyone to walk over and just be like, coffee with the green lid, that's the one you want? Or is it like, was it spoken about really?
No, in Bluefield, I was unaware of them, and I was gone from Bluefield quickly because I moved up. But I think in A-ball, they started appearing. And then when I got, I remember in AAA, they were out in the open. They were just like in a bowl. Complete guys didn't know what they were doing. You're just, hey, give me a couple of those. Hey, try that green one. That's a good one. So, but the thing about the amphetamines, keep in mind, I mean, I've never used drugs in my life. I drink too much, but I never went down the drug road. I went down the booze road. And they weren't thought of as drugs. They were like, you know, now we have Advil and Motrin or Red Bull. This was like that. It wasn't heroin. It wasn't performing enhancing. It wasn't steroids. It didn't screw up your internal organs. And guys used to say, you could see when a pitcher was on it because he was twitchy. They were going to the rosin bag and, you know, and guys would get on the pitcher and say, those greenies are wearing off in the fourth inning, baby. And pitchers would tell me on our team that they stopped taking them because when they started to lose it, they didn't realize it. They still felt good. They felt up and their fastball was slowing down. They didn't know it. So pitchers stopped using them, to be honest. It was more middle infield like me.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Because you had to get up for every game. Pitchers are just going, you know, one out of every five. They had to find that intrinsic motivation.
Yeah, in a couple of years, I played every inning. So, you know, in the Texas or the California League where it's hot.
Yeah, you're telling me. Yeah. You mentioned like reading on the bus. You wrote a line for Max Patkin about Crash, said he even saw him read a book without pictures once. What was the mentality about having interest outside of baseball in the locker room, being interested in what's obviously Vietnam's going on, like being interested in what's going on in the world beyond baseball? There's a difference between finding entertainment, like going to soaps or going to matinees, like you wrote about, and actually taking interest in the outside world and being someone who brings that in the locker room.
I learned not to bring it into the locker room. You know, I was seriously upset about the Vietnam War. I was not a pacifist. I just debated against it in college. I knew a lot about it. I, I'd lost friends there, guys that I played baseball with growing up. Didn't seem like a place we should be, losing American lives, killing innocent people. But nobody wanted to talk about it. In a certain way, everybody's afraid of getting drafted also, because if you got released, you might get drafted. And if you, some guys who were single joined the National Guard, so they wouldn't get drafted, hope they didn't go to Vietnam. Bobby Gritch was in the National Guard. Guys who were married were quickly having babies, because if you had a baby and you're married, you had less chance to be drafted. So this was in the air everywhere, but nobody really liked to talk about it. And the other thing going on at the time was that the civil rights movement was in, you know, full swing, and cities were on fire. Remember, this was Cleveland was on fire, the Chicago riots. I mean, it was a crazy time. Late 60s, early 70s, sex, drugs, rock and roll, Vietnam, civil rights, acid, Jimi Hendrix. I mean, you know, I'm playing baseball. And so in a certain way, we're in a bubble, but a certain way we weren't. But people didn't want to talk about it. Guys didn't want to talk about it.
In your book, you express some regret. You walk away during the 72 strike, thought the season might get canceled. You chose to move on with your life. How much of the Crash character, I always think about when he walks, fuck this fucking game, leaves Skip's office, comes back in, who we playing tomorrow? Still coming to the ballpark and getting a paycheck. How much of that internal, I want to keep coming to the ballpark, keep playing, was based on your kind of internal regret of walking away from baseball?
Well, I talk about that in the book. I do have regrets, but at the time, in a certain way, I didn't want to turn into Crash Davis. I didn't want to be doing this when I was 35 if I wasn't in the big leagues, I got married, and it was not a good life for a wife. I had 5 years, and again, the strike happened. There was no spring training, and then the season didn't start. It was a shortened season. So for 3 or 4 months, it looked like there was going to be no season at all. And that's when I made the commitment to go back to college.
So flash forward 15 years, as you do in the book, as a guy who played two sports in college, baseball professionally, how did you feel about the sports movie genre, I guess, pre-Bull Durham or even like pre-Best of Times? There'd been that huge surge kind of starting with Rocky, Bad News Bears, and Natural comes out, obviously, Raging Bull and the running one wins Best Picture. When you start writing Best of Times, is it riding a sports movie wave? Is it, I have interest in this, I want to do this? Or is there any bit of, hey, I can tell these stories better, I've been there?
Well, I just fell in love with movies. Is that I talk about the book when I was playing baseball, because they would get me out of a hotel or the motel. And I started to get fascinated with movies, but never thinking I'd do it. When I finally did become a writer and started to have some success, I felt, most sports movies I don't like. There are some that I like, but mostly they're about the home run in the bottom of the ninth. Guess what, folks? It almost never happens. The walk-off rarely happens. So I said, I think I can tell these stories from a point of view, from the athlete's point of view, not the fan's point of view. Because the athlete's looking at a different game than the fans and has a different take on everything. So that's all I tried to do. I mean, I point out later when I became a story editor, and the script of Platoon came across our desk, it was like, wow, this is great. This guy obviously was in the foxholes in Vietnam. This could not have been written by anybody else. And in a certain way, I wanted my sports movies to feel like, well, this guy's been there, because I'm seeing stuff I didn't know existed, or seeing an angle on the story, So that is true, that to this day, I'm still working on sports stories. Hold on here. This is a Ted Williams famous book about Ted Williams. I'm working on that. Ted Williams in his 60s when he's a fisherman in the Keys. And
about the writer Kramer, right?
It's Kramer's book we optioned. Yeah, it's about the writer, great writer, going down to see a guy who doesn't want to see him. And it's a great book, and we're in the middle of that, writing that. I've got a book that we're going to develop about Rose versus Giamatti, those 6 months. And You know, I call it the most reflective man who ever lived meets the least reflective man who ever lived. And we have Bryan Cranston's going to play Giamatti. So just anyway, so I can't get away from sports, I guess.
As someone, so I've spent the last 3 years on the show kind of complaining that they don't make as many sports movies now. And that is just, that is music to my ears on all fronts.
They're hard to get made, Kyle. Because they don't have baseball doesn't have any appeal, and they like to finance movies with a lot of foreign. And that's the trick. So you've got to get a movie star or two and make them for a price, which is what I'm trying to do.
So that's actually something I wanted to ask you, I guess, kind of jumping into Tin Cup, or at least the Tin Cup question. There's a ton of baseball. We're just talking American movie, ton of baseball movies. There's a lot of baseball movies, combat sports like boxing. They're going to be making boxing movies until you and I are both long gone. A lot of basketball movies too. There are very few golf movies and good golf movies. Tin Cup is the one that this isn't like blowing smoke up your ass. Tin Cup accomplishes the feat of filming golf and showing a tournament and being in that feel the best. There are some others that do, you know, the shots. We recently did The Greatest Game Ever Played on this show. There's, you know, Bagger Vance has its other problems. Golf has international appeal, especially now. It's getting more and more popular. I know you're a big fan of golf. I know we share a distaste for live golf, which is nice. Is there something more difficult about getting golf on the ground, off the ground, or filming golf? Like, is it more of a challenge? It is, you know, spread out as opposed to one stadium, one court, one arena. Does that factor into getting golf movies off the ground?
It's a great question, because I have one called Q School. And I wrote it with John Norville, who wrote Tin Cup with me. John, wonderful writer, but he also played golf at Stanford. So you know how good you have to be to play at Stanford.
Yeah, that's where Tiger went.
Yeah, and Tom Watson, among others. So we've had trouble getting it off the ground. It's a really good script. We're still trying Q School. It's about a guy. Oh, you'll love this one. A Major League Baseball star who's now in his mid-40s, and like Mike Schmidt and Johnny Bench and some others, he's kind of on the bubble of the Hall of Fame, and he just loves the rush of the crowd and the competition, and he's a colorful, big, wonderful, lovable, sexy blowhard of a guy, kind of, you know, he's our kind of guy. I mean, full of shit, but he kind of knows it, you know, and he's not a liar, and he has worked very hard. Now he's a scratch golfer like Bench and Schmidt. And so he goes to the Q School to try to qualify. And it's about those 6 days, but there's several other characters and women and his rivals and what happened. So it's a great story. And it's the hardest sport to shoot, because it's not dynamic in the way other sports are. There's not the ballet. It's basically, and I've been to many, many professional golf tournaments, you walk in there and it's quiet. It's like a cathedral. And it's 120 guys for 2 days doing exactly the same thing. You don't know who's winning if there wasn't a television guy telling you, or the big reader boards, which aren't very dramatic. So in that regard, it's a tricky sport to make. You know, boxing is the easiest because it's two guys in underwear trying to knock each other out. You don't need to explain.
It's an easy plot device, boxing. The question, so in the past, I guess, since I've been doing this show, I've always championed the phrase cast athletes, not actors. And I kind of say, hey, unless you need someone to go out and win you an Oscar, you can teach an athlete to act, and athletes stuff comes through on camera. If you're shooting a sports movie, the way athletes carry themselves and act, that stuff comes through, and you can teach someone. I look at Miracle as the biggest example of this, where they cast a bunch of actual hockey players, and the one guy who you could cover with the mask, the goalie, they cast an actor. Would you agree with that statement, or is there a certain time where you can't teach someone to act? There are things that you need an actor to do that a lot of times you can't teach an athlete. You've been blessed with Costner, who is both, but is there merit to just cast an athlete and you can teach them the rest?
There's truth in what you say, and I love working with athletes because but you can't ask them to act outside. You know, athletes playing athletes is one thing. Athletes doing Shakespeare is something else. So as long as you keep them in their world, they're great. I mean, I had, you know, in 10 Cup, we had, you know, the two guys who were comfortable on camera, Peter Jacobson and Craig Stadler, they were fine with their line.
Yeah.
Costner was a really, really good athlete. Tommy Lee Jones was an All-American, not All-American, all Ivy League football player at Harvard, first string. So if I have a guy that I need an actor, I really want them to have an athletic background. I really do. One thing about working with actors, athletes, is you can tell them to do the same thing over and over and over, and they're used to it. That's what athletes do in muscle memory. You know, you'll practice the pickoff play 600 times a day in spring training. So they never get bored. They entertain themselves. They chat. They make jokes. They don't complain. Where actors get a little bit prima donna-ish sometimes. So I'm happy to have athletes wherever I can.
Well, and that's where, I mean, I think that's where all your movies succeed, in that they're filled with athletes or actors who at least have played in the past and fill those vibes. And I think that works, you know, hand over hand. I'm going to leave most Bull Durham questions off this interview, because I want to encourage people to read the book, where you go deeply, deeply in depth. And it is like, it's a true treat, and it's more than we could ever accomplish in these last few minutes. But the one thing is the scene that you mentioned that you had to cut between Annie and Crash at a bar, the why baseball scene, where Annie kind of explains her backstory. And you mentioned that it hurt a little bit. It was kind of like a kill your darlings moment of this scene. Didn't work with test audiences, might not work the movie or something like that. When you cut this scene, there's like the old adage of the guy who's had his heart broken, so he doesn't let himself, you know, doesn't let himself love again. Is that on your mind when you write White Man Can't Jump or Blue Chips or Tin Cup or something like that, is maybe not falling in love with certain material or thinking that there's ever something that a movie can live without? Or after that experience, did you have to, I'm sticking with my guns, this is right for the movie and in other films?
No, I'm ruthless. When you get into the editing room, I'm ruthless. That doesn't mean you have a pang of pain, because it's good work. And the famous scene, or the not famous, infamous, the scene that I talk about that we cut out, it wasn't so much the test audiences didn't like it. It was just the editor and me and a couple others felt the movie lost. We had everybody, and it kind of takes a breath for this serious scene. And then it gets going again. And it was so intimate, this conversation between these two people who had not yet found each other physically, that it was like, well, the movie's over. They're like, they're so close already, they're talking like that. That's what I learned, is to save the, put the emotional reveal in the right place. So when we took the scene out to test it, the movie just sailed and said, we can't put it back. So, I mean, talk to editors I've worked with, they'll say it, I am ruthless. Even, you know, when you write it and direct it, and sometimes it's four all-nighters, and you get it in the editing room and say, get rid of it. I mean, you know, you kill your darlings all the time if you're any good, I think.
Well, I mean, it worked for Bull Durham. Regarded as a masterpiece, it was a hit, things like that. I've got my little picture of Crash and Nuke right there. Like, it's endured. It was your first directorial feature. You've done a million since. You've done a lot since. With that being said, if you were doing Bull Durham with experienced eyes, as opposed to the first time, do you think you could have done it better? Do you think you would have maybe done some things that inadvertently wouldn't have made the movie as good if you were doing it with experience? Like, was there benefit to being a rookie and making that movie?
Probably. That's a good observation. You don't know what you don't know, in a certain sense. And, you know, you also think, I also thought, this is the only chance I'll ever get to make a movie, so I'll fight for every second. And the book is all about those fights. And I happen to win most of the fights. You don't always win the fights, I've learned.
Literal fights.
Yeah, well, in action, one case, an actual fight. But yeah, I think there's something to that. At the same time, I'm a better director now. And I couldn't get that movie made today, because nobody would, they'd say, what do you mean? It's in the minor leagues. And always, You know, Kevin Costner wasn't a star yet. Who's ever heard of Tim Robbins? That's what they say. And there's no big game. Do they win the league? No, they're not even on the team at the end of the movie. Nuke's gone. Crash is gone. Maybe to Visalia, of all places. Which is, by the way, 30 minutes from Bakersfield.
So you've mentioned before that the sequel to Bull Durham that you've talked out imagines Crash is now managing AAA Durham. Annie's teaching at Duke. Nuke's in Venezuela. They all find a way to reconnect. The Q School idea that you mentioned on Rich Eisen's show, you mentioned that was originally a tin cup has to go to Q School. I won't make you rehash out everything you did on Rich Eisen's show about where your characters are now, but in with the sports movie characters, who has the most left to tell? Which, if you could re-explore one, you know, bring someone back, who in your mind, where's the most meat on the bone?
If I could revisit one of these guys now?
Yeah.
Years later? Oh, that's a great question. Well, it's not Woody. Wesley's character is interesting. I mean, Al Stumps is very interesting because he ended up in controversy himself, but I think unfairly so. Crash remains a pretty interesting guy, I'd say. I think Crash.
Yeah, I mean.
Mainly because, as I say, he loves something more than it loves him back. And that's the game. But we've all loved somebody, something, a job, a person, more than it's that thing or person has loved us back. And that, I think, it makes Bull Durham more universal than just a baseball movie. But I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of that when I was making it. I did that. Somebody told me that 10 years later. You know why this movie works, Ron? It's about a guy who loves something more than loves. I went, oh, you're right. I was just telling the story about two guys and a woman.
Speaking on love in that regard, I feel like with your sports movies, they all work because they seem to be about something that you personally as the writer love. Love minor league baseball. That stuff comes through, you know, the pickup hoops aspect. There's love behind the sport. Even in Tin Cup, this flawed character who makes a very questionable decision on 18 at the US Open, just built out of love. And it's, I would say the sport, things are positive. I was curious again when I was doing some prep and I was listening to you talk about LIV Golf on Rich Eisen, and LIV Golf, like LIV Golf stinks. It's a stain. Can you make a good, would you personally be able to make a good sports movie about a part of sport that you hate, that you have distaste for, a negative sports movie?
Another good question. Probably not. The one exception, I developed a script that we thought was going to get made at HBO, and then it didn't, based on the book Game of Shadows. Game of Shadows is a fabulous book. It's like All the President's Men, except it's about the discovery of performance-enhancing drugs. It's two investigative reporters in San Francisco in 2001 or two, whenever it was, were asked, go investigate this little lab called the Bay Area Lab Company, Balco, was raided by the local police south of San Francisco Airport last night. Go check it out. Well, it turns into discovering, you know, Victor Conti and the fact that, you know, Bonds is juiced, Marion Thompson's juiced, half the league is juiced, or the Olympian, and it blew it up. And it's a great book. It's also tragic because it reveals this kid, you know, young boys' brains are still forming, and steroid rage happens with teenagers, and there's a lot of teenage suicides at the time of kids taking this stuff. And so it's about a part of the world I hate, but it would be a positive story because it's uncovering the truth. I still would like to get that made. I don't know if we can ever get it made, but that would be the only exception. You're absolutely right. I have to like the world I'm working in.
Yeah, see, it's something that comes through in all your movies, and I think that's why people fell in love with minor league. I mean, Bull Durham is credited with reinvigorating the town of Durham and just the minor leagues in general. And so I think that comes through. Before I let you out of here, I have a quick-ish rapid fire that I want to run some stuff by you. Okay. And get some answers, and I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah, I could. I don't have to. I never have to buy a drink in Durham. Honest to God,
oh,
I could
sure.
be
sure. I'm sure. And it's so interesting. I've been to one Bulls game. I went to go watch a friend rehab there. And the crowd was, because minor league, you're there, typically you're there for, you know, Thirsty Thursday or Dollar, you know, hot dogs. It's a place you can take your kids, things like that. The Durham crowd was more into the game than any minor league crowd I've ever seen. And more, and that franchise that especially, you know, since becoming the Rays has won a lot. And it's a significant home field advantage that I'm not sure exists in a lot of other parts of minor league baseball now.
Yeah, I did book signings down there this year after New York on the book, which I love because nobody's ever done book signings at a ballpark. And we had 150 people in line, and I threw out the first pitch, the whole thing. And they were a Rays franchise. They were in first place again. So, yeah, I take credit for building that park and completely rehabbing the city of Durham, just so you know that.
As well you should. Okay, quick rapid fire. Favorite minor league park that you played in? So not Durham.
Silver Stadium, Rochester.
Best pitcher you ever faced?
Best pitcher, this is rapid fire. I can't remember his name. Jack Billingham. In terms of three pitches, he got me on three pitches that.
And so you stood up, you went up there and went right back to the dugout without knowing what happened.
And I never struck out looking. I looked, took a three and went back. It was a winter ball. The guy said nobody would have swung at those. You're fine. Don't worry about it. But on one at bat, it was Jack Billingham.
Best actor athlete who is not Kevin Costner?
Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, okay. This is related to something I need to know for a book project that I am working on. How many pitches do you think that Nuke threw that night? He's sitting on 126 minimum with the 18 and 18.
Oh, 175 easy.
Yeah, it's quite the night for Nuke. Sports movie you wish you could have directed, either because you loved it or you want to save it.
Wow. Well, I'd like to do the real Babe Ruth story.
Not the one you mentioned in your book. When did that come out?
I don't know, but William Binnicks was 45 playing an orphan. The real Babe Ruth story is probably a mini series based on Lee Montville's book, The Big Bam. Read that. This guy is bigger than any character you could imagine. Shakespearean, out of control, bawdy, X-rated movie. I mean, it's out there.
I'm in on you doing that. The last one, every guest from Phenom to the Farm gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Oh, how much time you got?
As much as you have, which is not much.
I think the worst one ever was, we're going only from Dallas to Memphis, I think, or Little Rock, which isn't that far, but the bus broke down. And it's 100 degrees and there's no AC. And we're out there, ball players. This is Double-A too. And we had to get a big road grader from a freeway project to come over and push the bus so the busy could pop the clutch and get it started again, which took all afternoon. And we played a game that night. So that was the broke down bus story. Yeah, I think that's my best.
Every single one of those stories usually has a theme of bus broke down, no AC, bathrooms backed up, something of that nature. It's been 50 years since you were in the minor leagues, and some things change, some things stay exactly the same. Ron Shelton, this was an absolute pleasure. Everyone go buy the Church of Baseball, The Making of Bull Durham, Home Runs, Bad Calls, Crazy Fights, Big Swings, and a Hit. Ron, thank you so much for joining the show.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
And that's it for today's episode from Phenom of the Farm. Huge thanks to the great Ron Shelton for stopping by, walking us through his career. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to subscribe to Every Gear Podcast, rate and leave a review for an Apple Podcast or Spotify, and we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
We
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.